Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Two Crickets and a Thorn Tree, the smoothest glass of Amarula for your mind in the Southern Hemisphere. I'm half of your hosts, Nicholas Lorimer. And of course, as always, joined by the other half of your hosts, Mr.
Gabriel Krauser.
Right, so I think we are actually recording on a Friday today, and hopefully this will go up on Friday or maybe on Saturday.
Wait, Nick, you didn't say our catchline. Our catchline is Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree, the smoothest glass of...
No, I did say that.
For your mind, this side of Mars.
This side of Mars. Oh, okay. I didn't realize that we had expanded our scope so much.
We had in a dream I had, and now it is reality.
Speaking of Mars, do you see how Elon Musk is trolling the stock market again?
Yeah, I have a view on this, which is that, and Dogecoin's, I had this view before Dogecoin went up. 1 minute spiel, because this is not a major topic. So I've got a close older friend who has been in the crypto space for years and trying to use, for example, he tried to offer a product that would allow government to use blockchain technology to manage the social grant system in a way that would be super cheap. And so on and so forth. Okay. So a smart IT guy used to work at one of the big smart IT companies and sort of now tries to help out in South Africa. That's one reason I've got views about crypto. Another reason is because I read David Graeber's book, Debt to History 5,000 Years, in 2012, and it changed my life. And in 2012, he was writing about Bitcoin just when it came out and crypto. And in 2013, I lived with a guy who was in the world's first Bitcoin hedge fund, or 2014, whatever it was, in Moscow. So I'm saying this because I'd like my authority rather than my arguments to have some weight to make the following very simple point. Most people have thought about Bitcoin as a currency for a very long time, and that's because stupid, okay? Bitcoin, to the smarty pants, it's never been useful to think about it as a currency. Do you think about bonds as a currency? Would you like to buy a Coca-Cola with a South African bond, or pay for your electricity with a South African bond, or with stocks in Anglo-American or Mittal steel? No. Bitcoin, from the very beginning, it's not a new idea that Bitcoin takes so much energy to mine and takes an amount of energy to transfer that it doesn't make sense to use it at scale in the same way that we use 5 rand coins or the digital equivalent thereof. Okay. Thinking of it as currency, in my opinion, and an opinion that's remained unchanged more or less since 2012, has always been silly. And the guys who use Bitcoin to buy pizzas, everyone laughs at that story today for a few good reasons. One of the good reasons is that if you bought a pizza for a Bitcoin, you got one pizza for what would now be worth 1 million rand. so that is funny. But it's also funny because it is always a gimmick. Anyone who had the slightest inkling of how it actually works knew that that was a gimmick. Okay. What Bitcoin is much more like is like a bond, but a bond with no coupon. So that sucks. Usually you buy a bond and you get 2% of that bond's value back every year, and you don't get that with Bitcoin. But unlike with bonds, there's no government that can increase the total quantity, and that's kind of a good thing. You just follow the basics of supply and demand. The supply can't ever go up. So as the demand increases, the price will increase, and that's how you make your money. So Elon Musk did a couple of smart things. One of them was to stop pretending like Bitcoin is a clever way to pay for Teslas. Bitcoin is not a clever – why?
Well, no, he didn't say
– imagine General Electric saying –
Hold on, slow down.
Here's our policy. Because General Electric or General Motors is an American company, and we really like American bonds, and we really want people to get more into the American bond market, you can buy your Ford or your electricity or whatever using an American bond. That would be a crazy way to try and boost the demand for American bonds. And it's crazy to think that Bitcoin are good for buying Teslas. That's just not the kind of thing Bitcoin is or ever was or ever will be. It is a useful way to hide your money from the predations of expansionary monetary policy from and so on, and inflation and hedging against stock market crashes. There's all kinds of reasons to buy Bitcoin. Use the thought that you can buy Bitcoin to then later use it to buy something else without transferring it into an actual medium of exchange is silly. And he's pushed back against that a little bit while at the same time going on SNL, bragging about having Asperger's, being hilarious in his super awkward, I'm a billionaire who's flipping reinvented the space rocket and has ideas about tubes and reinvented the electric car. You know, I'm so amazing that you might as well just laugh at how weird I am. He made himself likable and familiar, but weirdly, the only secondary for people who've actually watched the SNL skits, and by the way, SNL has put those skits on YouTube, which they didn't used to do. So you can actually just watch it, and it's funny. But instead, everyone's like thinking that this wasn't a comedic appearance about his personality, but is instead part of a ploy to really screw around with the stock market. Okay, Nick, give me your comeback. I can see you waiting.
So the way it's been reported, the way it's been kind of carried in the news, and I don't know if he said anything in addition to this, is that he doesn't have a problem with buying bitcoins, with using bitcoins to buy Teslas. He just thinks that it uses too much electricity and this is bad for the environment.
That is a problem.
Right. So he's so not.
He does have a
not,
problem.
Right. He's not accepted your argument that Bitcoin is not good for a currency.
That is my argument. The reason it's not good for a currency. One way to think about it is that it's bad for the environment. Another way to think about it is that it's expensive.
Right. But I do think there is a distinction there to some degree. So he's saying. He's basically saying, look, you know, when we create the fusion reactor or whatever, then it's absolutely cool. I'm going to do Bitcoin as a currency.
Oh, if energy suddenly becomes free, which the fusion reactor, you know, okay, it won't make it free, but, you know, if energy is
super cheap, yeah.
Super duper cheap, then that changes the game somewhat. But it still doesn't change the game. Look, I don't want to get into the details of this because I can't remember the terminology. But here's one way to think about it. There's a very nice report. One way to think about it, which spells things out like this, and I'm just going to use vague language. A credit card company like Visa or MasterCard deals with just a bazillion transactions per day, okay?
Right.
They use
That's a very large number, Brazilian.
A Brazilian is more than a gazillion, okay? But it's less than a bedillion. If we must get it, or quintillion, okay? Brazilian is just the right number for a number that you can't remember. They do a Brazilian transactions every day, and it would be super expensive to do it in one way. That's hyper secure. So here's what they do. They do all the daily transactions in like a secure way, but less secure. And then at the end of the day, you close the accounts by doing another kind of transaction. Because what often happens is I bank with X bank, and I buy something from a company that also banks with X Bank, all that's really happening is that the bank is changing the actual currency of rands is never involved. The bank is just moving something on its books. But when I buy something from another bank, then the one bank has to transfer a sort of real value to the other bank. So the banks figure out what is the net difference at the end of the day. I bought something from a company that's at that bank, but someone who banks with that bank bought from a company that banks with my bank. So if we bought exactly the same amount, the banks wouldn't have to exchange any money. The net would be zero. But if someone bought slightly more than the other person, then there is a net change. So at the end of the day, there's a net transfer, and that uses a different kind of system. Now, that kind of system, the transfers are, let's say, you know, $20 per transaction, whereas the transfers on the little, when I tap my card at the Pick and Pay, that is like 2 cents per transaction.
Right.
Now, Bitcoin costs about $25 per transaction.
Right. So it can't be used for all the little thingies.
But it can be used for interbank exchange. Or it's the same kind of cost that you bear if you're buying a lot of stocks. Part of the way that a stock broker like the one that you used and that the Wall Street Bets guys used is that they have a similar underwriting system, where they're kind of holding the value for you, like a bank is holding value for you. So that's how they make it super cheap. But that's also why they have to have a clearance at the end of the day, which is why they have to have a certain amount of reserves, which makes it weaker. It means if there's a huge change in the market, it's not just because they're nefarious dudes. They actually have to stop some of the exchanges because they won't be able to meet their clearance requirements. So the guys who don't want to be at risk of that, and that is all professional investors, use another instrument, and that instrument, unless they're doing for regular bond and stock security trades, it is going to come out as a much more expensive way of going about it. And then high frequency traders basically build their own platform to have their own clearance, and then within that do a bazillion transactions per second, and they use laser beams to make it super fast. And this all sounds like it's not true because I'm putting it in a flippant way, but it's actually true, and this is how it works. And so Bitcoin should be thought of not like Visa and MasterCard, but more like the banking company system clearance consortium that you've never even heard of, but that deals in like hundreds of billions of dollars in clearance a day, at $20 a transaction or whatever. That's what it's like the deep background. And Dogecoin, Ethereum, Dogecoin in particular, is much cheaper. It's much more like the whatever. So Bitcoin, Dogecoin, but look, I'm not saying that's how they ought to relate. And there's a huge crypto war to be the guy who gets the MasterCard kind of clearance, cheap clearance thing. And there's a huge war about then how do you index that value? Do you want to index it to dollars? Do you want to index it to Bitcoin? Do you want to index it to something else? That indexing is happening in some parts, but not in other parts. It's all very up in the air. And all that Elon Musk did was, as a joke, say that Bitcoin is a hustle. And you should watch the clip. I mean, he's not saying it's a hustle.
I had no idea he said that. I thought that the trolling thing was saying, oh, the whole world is going to be able to buy, Teslas and the thing. And then suddenly, as though he hadn't thought about it, kind of like 2 weeks later being like, oh, so, oops, sorry, guys, didn't realize how much electricity it used. Guess we won't do that anymore.
I do agree that was a little bit silly. And I think it's always silly to say you can buy Teslas with Bitcoin.
He's done that before. Follow the money. He's done that before with the price of Tesla stock price, right? He said something like, to be honest, kind of think that Tesla's overpriced right now and caused a huge drop in the stock price.
And that's and I would call it, I mean, he and Warren Buffett agreed.
He may not have been lying or anything like that. In fact, I think he was completely correct. But to sort of tweet it out like that and be a bit sort of flippant about it does kind of come off as a bit trollish.
Yeah, the board has definitely tried to get rid of him a few times for not foolishly advertising Tesla all the way. But dude, I mean, would you rather have a CEO that's always just saying the next quarter is going to be the best quarter in the world, or a CEO that's like, frankly, our market capitalization is not justified by our revenues or our potential growth in market share. So, yes, our stock price is overvalued and now's a good time to sell. I mean, I think that kind of ballsy honesty, he sounds the only analog that I can think of it in history is like the British aristocrat in the 19th century. It's like, well, you know, my estate's not that good. And my cardigan's a little bit holy. But let me tell you a joke about a Frenchman and a German and a Russian walking into a saloon. You know, he is just that kind of silly, quirky.
He's a crazy eccentric, a mad billionaire. I think I've said this before on the podcast, how I think they're quite valuable. Anyway, that was a complete digression because that was a completely flippant throwaway comment that I had barely thought about. And I didn't realize I was about to uncork a bottle of, I'm not quite sure what that was, but whatever it was, it was quite intense. So now that you've inevitably angered people who like Bitcoin,
talk about?
Okay, yes, no, I know.
Just not as a currency.
I know, but there are a lot of people who are very passionate about. Yeah, you're taking a position that irritates kind of everyone there. I think, if it's right. So now that we've irritated all of those people, let's irritate more people by talking about Israel and Palestine. That was a good segue.
Very well.
If I do say so myself.
No, I agree. I'd like to pause and have a sip of process. The hot flaming anger that's already emerged.
As we speak and over the past couple of days, there has been a big flare-up in violence between Israel and Palestine. At least sort of 50 people or so have been killed, probably more. I know that a senior Hamas leader was killed, I think, last night maybe even, by Israel. And although there are some motions towards negotiation to have another ceasefire, it does seem like this round is a bit more intense than we've had for a while of conflict between the two sides. So I think it's a difficult story to tell, partially because, you know, everyone gets so heated about this topic that it's very difficult to find out what everyone agrees was the cause. So I think there's several explanations you could put forward. The one I've heard, and I think the one that many sort of pro-Palestinian people have put forward, is that it's related to this case, which is quite an interesting one. You might be interested in this in a property rights perspective. I don't know if you've heard about it, Gabriel, but so the story is, in the 1870s, a group of Jewish settlers bought some land in East Jerusalem, or was it West Jerusalem? I don't know. Anyway, a suburb of Jerusalem, they bought some territory there. Then, so they bought that from...
Did you say the
1870s? 1870s, yes. So they bought this, like, in the early days of the Zionist project, when the area was ruled by the Ottoman Empire. So a very long time ago. Anyway, they got their title deeds and stuff, and they then sort of ran that property, people living there, until 1947, when Israel's sort of independence war happens, and Jordan occupies the part of Jerusalem that this land was in. And so, you know, the Jewish settlers basically lost their land rights and they fled to Israel, but they kept the title deeds.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to 1976, the Israelis, in the Six-Day War, retake this part of Jerusalem, or take this part of Jerusalem, I suppose, from the Jordanians, and it's now, you know, under Israeli control. But in the meantime, the Jordanians have moved a bunch of Palestinian families in there and said, hey, you guys can stay in this property, basically.
Sorry, quick fact check. The Six-Day War was 1967, not 76. Okay, but after the Six-Day War...
The number's confused, but yes, yeah. In 1967.
Israel gets that land, and now the guys want to move back in. They're like, hey, we've got our title deeds.
Yeah, and so the Palestinian settlers who say, they are like, yeah, well, the government put us here, and it's not our fault, and, you know, you guys, you're all a bunch of invaders anyway, so, like... don't tell us to move. So they come to some sort of agreement where the people living there are going to pay rent.
To the title deed holders or to the government?
To the title deed holders, I think, yeah.
Okay, so we don't have to move anyone, but you do need to pay the money.
Right. So I'm not 100, you might want your listeners, if they're curious about this case, might want to fact check me on some of this, because I'm not 100% sure, but I believe what happens then is, some of this rent doesn't get paid. Eventually, there's sort of general non-payment, and the people living there are basically sort of, legally squatting, sort of legally, illegally squatting in this sort of gray area. So the people who own the land, they sell it to someone else, and he's a developer, and he's like, okay, cool, I can't get rent from these guys. This land is quite valuable because, you know, it's in Jerusalem, and so I want to move you guys all out because you're not paying rent, and I want to build a development here. So this has now gone to court in Israel, and I think it's now on its – it was on its way to the Supreme Court just before this violence broke out.
It's still on its way, yeah.
So the sort of Palestinian side says, well, you guys are all occupiers and invaders anyway, and that title deed doesn't make sense because it's very old and blah, 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 blah. So you guys should just – leave these people alone. Don't evict them. This is their home. They've been living there for, you know, decades. This is cruel and stuff. And so the eviction itself and the police action to evict the people resulted, I think, in violence. People throwing stones at the cops beating up people. That gave Israel a lot of bad press. And that has been one of the things used as the sort of catalyst, I think, for this conflict. But I think there's more to the story, as there always is whenever you see a flare up in the...
Oh, for sure. There's also been lots of tension around important prayers in the build-up to Eid, COVID restrictions, and of course there was the terrible tragedy on the Israeli side where I think 50 people were trampled to death in such a strange and sad nightmare that became a reality. But that wasn't the only one. There was also sort of nasty encounters between cops and Muslims trying to have public prayers. And there's a lot of tension about more and more Jews basically praying in spots that are considered to be, well, both Jewish and Muslim sacred sites. And
right. So I think one of the tensions is that the Dome of the Rock is the big mosque in Jerusalem, the big shiny one with the golden dome. And that is built on the site of the Temple Mount, which is the holiest place in Judaism. So since Jordan was kicked out of the area, the Temple Mount has been, and the Dome of the Rock Mosque have been run by a Jordanian association. It was part of the sort of agreement. So even though the territory is occupied by Israel, it's run by this Jordanian agreement. And they said, no Jews to pray here. This is a Muslim site.
Yeah.
So Jewish nationalists, I think every year, do a march where they go past one of these spots or relatively close to it. And it's basically calling for the thing to be open to Jews and other stuff too, like and so this year there also seemed to have been some panic amongst the people running the mosque that these marchers would storm the mosque, and so a crowd gathered to defend it, and that was also a cause of some sort of tensions. But I think the point here is that there's so much bad blood basically between the two sides that, you know, if you're looking for a grievance to start something over, it's very easy to find one.
Yeah.
Someone did something to someone somewhere, and so it's very easy to be like, and this is the reason why we're going to shoot rockets or drop bombs or whatever.
Yeah.
My theory onto why there's been this little flare-up in violence is that the Palestinians in the West Bank, who are governed by Fatah, which is the party of Mahmoud Abbas, as opposed to Gaza, which is governed by Hamas. Fatah is kind of in a sort of awkward agreement with the Israelis, where the Israelis have largely demilitarized them and, you know, occupy their territory. But at the same time, they let them run parts of the West Bank, whereas Hamas is completely hostile to Israel and is basically blockaded in Gaza. The Palestinians last had election in 2004, I think it was, in the West Bank, and
Since the Ottoman Empire, but not as recently as
right, so a long time ago, and Fatah won that, but every time that the four-year term of their president has expired, Fatah has basically said, oh, well, we can't hold the election now, and the reason for that is widely believed to be because they suspect that they will lose to Hamas in an election, and they don't want to lose power.
And a lot of people are like, okay, well, that's fine. Don't have an election because Hamas would be worse.
Right. This is kind of suits the Israelis because they don't want to have to basically fight Hamas in the West Bank as well. So recently, Fatah cancelled the elections again, which were scheduled to be held, I think, quite soon. Either this year or next year, which is, you know, once again extending Mahmoud Abbas's term. And I suspect that part of what's going on here is actually it's Hamas trying to unseat Fatah starting a conflict with Israel, and then in the sort of chaos they can undermine Fatah, and they can also make Fatah look weak. I mean, Hamas basically says, you know, you guys are the lapdogs of the Israelis. We need to throw you out and replace you with, you know, people who will stand up for the Palestinians. So that's definitely part of it. Part of it is also the fact that Iran is supplying Hamas with new tech, better missiles than they normally have, or better rockets. So, you know, with that better tech, I think that Hamas feels a little bit stronger than it normally does.
Yeah.
Maybe it thought that it was a good time to cause some trouble for Israel. Also, the Israelis have recently killed, I think, or are very strongly alleged to have killed some Iranian nuclear scientists, among other things, and also using another computer virus for the second time to destroy Iranian nuclear facilities. So it may be that Iran is saying to their allies in Hamas, guys, why don't you just do us a favor and hit these dudes back for killing our guy?
Yeah.
What's your take on it, Gabriel? Do you think I'm missing anything? Do you think I'm wrong about anything?
No, I mean, I think you're broadly right. There's disputed property rights, which is just about the oldest reason in the book to go to war. There is a longstanding ethnic, racial, religious tension. In fact, I said I should have said and, because all three of those texts are brought to bear. The etiology of this conflict is sort of traces back ultimately thousands of years. And the balance of forces in the very recent past are, I think, largely as you've described it. Iran, Tehran, very antagonistic to Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and allies. I think the forward-looking thing to note, on which I'm sure you'll see a piece shortly, not coming from me, but check out the Daily Friend, is that Israel might be in a sort of knowably vulnerable position. In the sense that, okay, so just a bit of context. Israel's Iron Dome, pretty solid, but like 400 rockets.
With the anti-missile defense system that shoots down the Palestinian rockets.
Yeah, when they use missiles to shoot down rockets. But some of those rockets got through, and only a few hundred were launched. So if a few thousand are launched, it's like when a few hundred are launched, 2% get through. When a few thousand are launched, more like 10% get through, right? Mm. This sort of overwhelms it. So the Iron Dome is amazing. It really is amazing, but it's not perfect. And that's one thing to note. Another thing to note is then what happens is the Iron Dome strikes these things down, and then the Israelis launch these guided missiles to take out the rocket launch sites. And I think most people would be aware of a big building that was bombed. Some people could die. The way this is presented is that Israel will first launch a dud. They do all kinds of things to try and warn civilians to get in the clear. And one of the things on particularly targeted buildings is first they'll launch a dud. So it's called a knock on the roof. So you hear a dud, you know, a dud lands on the roof, and you're like, okay, well, this building is still around. I'm alive underneath, but an actual bomb is going to come shortly that's going to destroy it. So run away. So there's enough time between the dud and the real missile for people to run away, but not enough time to remove material, military infrastructure. And that system is not perfect. Some civilians do die, but it is the most restrained way, really, to take out military infrastructure that has been deliberately positioned inside a residential area. And if you think back a little bit to World War II or wars since then, you know, there really are much, much worse ways of doing it. Tokyo, I think almost 2/3 of Tokyo were firebombed.
Right, and like 50,000 people or something in one night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but over the course of it, hundreds of thousands of civilians. There's an argument to be made. In fact, I think it's pretty clear that more people were killed by quite a lot just by ordinary conventional bombs in Japan.
Than by the nuclear bombs.
And the nuclear bombs are memorable moments, but you should think of them as something like the tip of the iceberg. So why am I saying this? Well, on one version, Israel's precision missiles are ordered from America largely on a just-in-time basis. So a little bit like Toyota's revolutionary way of doing cars and such. You get the orders, you get the parts to make the car just in time so that you don't have to waste as much money on storage costs, basically. Yeah. And supply chain management. It's a more effective way to go. So they don't really have a huge stockpile of these things. And they might be in a position where America's got the stockpile but not as eager to sell them right now. So this matters because on this version, Hezbollah in the north, in Lebanon, has an order of...
Iran's other ally.
Yeah.
Right.
Have many more rockets. And so the thing to watch out for in the next couple of weeks is whether they then launch those rockets. And Israel's put in a position where it can't take out the rocket launch sites because it's run out of, in a relatively restrained way, because it's run out of targeted missiles. Mm-hmm. And can't afford not to take out those sites because the Iron Dome
will be overwhelmed. Tech, basically.
So it starts using conventional tech, which will kill hundreds of civilians, if not thousands. And that will create even more bad press. I mean, most importantly, it'll kill people, but in terms of the sort of national
context. Yeah.
With the sort of Jerusalem as the moral heart of the issue and Israel's killing of lots of civilians as the pumping blood, it might really inflame both the worst sides of sort of nationalism inside of Israeli politics and of nationalism inside Iranian politics to just make a real mess. The likes of which we haven't seen for many years. You might reverse some of the gains that have happened in the last few years where more Arab and Muslim majority countries have recognized Israel, have opened diplomatic channels with them, have canceled no flight zone and no trade, right. Opened up trade and all these kinds of good things that have happened might be put under pressure, but might reverse. And I'm just painting this as sort of worst case scenario, but it's, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the view I've always taken of the Abraham Accords, which is the peace agreement with the Saudis, the UAE, those places, is that that was really because it is a prelude to larger conflict between Israel and Iran, and that the dividing lines in the future will not be Jews and Muslims or Arabs and Israelis. It's going to be more complicated. Yeah, nation states, Israel, Saudi, UAE versus Iran and Turkey, possibly. Although Turkey has more. Is playing a very complicated game in the Middle East right now.
Yeah.
It's sort of acting as trying to establish itself as a regional power. And it's doing pretty well, actually.
Yeah.
Which I think is not so good because its President Erdogan is, to quote Donald Trump, a bad hombre. I think the other thing that's interesting about this whole thing is that Israel's going through a political crisis at the moment as well because they keep having to re-hold elections because no one can agree to form a government. Because the central character in Israeli politics is their current Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, or Bibi, as he's usually called. And he basically, as far as I understand, and I don't understand Israeli politics very well, but basically everyone has either become for or against Bibi. And the problem is Netanyahu doesn't seem to want to allow the possibility of a government that doesn't include him as Prime Minister. And yet the only thing necessary that the other parties will agree to is a coalition which doesn't have him as the Prime Minister. So it's a real mess. And I think they're going for their fifth election now. My friend in Israel, who I just want to say, continued to play computer games through a rocket attack near her house, which is quite something.
What else are you going to do? But really...
she's very annoyed at the prospect of having to vote again, especially because the last four or something have not produced much of a change in the political calculus.
Yeah, and so the effective strategy seems to be, can we just get some voter fatigue where one side's voters get bored enough and tired enough, frustrated enough that they just stop voting, and then the other side gets a proper majority.
And one of the things that looked like it was going to happen in just before this outbreak of hostilities, and maybe this was also a cause of everything to happen like it did, was that for the first time, the Arab parties, the parties that claim to represent Arab interests in Israel, looked like they might be brought in some sort of coalition to oust Benjamin Netanyahu. And this would have been the first time that an Arab party had been sort of involved in forming a government. Correct. Maybe they wouldn't, you know, maybe it wouldn't have lasted long or that kind of thing, but it would have been quite historic in that sense. And of course, the moment the hostilities broke out, tension soured and no one wanted to do it anymore, particularly because there's also been like sort of intercommunal violence. I think there's a town called Lot in Israel, which is mixed, you know, mixed Arab and Israeli.
Yeah.
And it devolved into violence. And that has basically soured relations, and so they couldn't form a coalition. So pretty bad
stuff. So I think that's the most important part of the story, right, is that Israel is complicated in the following sense. It is basically a theocracy, right? It's like a religious-based state.
Religious nationalist state, yeah.
So I think that that's a very bad idea. Right. Religious nationalist states, not a good idea. But here's a fun fact. The UK is a religion nationalist state. The head of state is
more literally a theocracy than Israel, because it actually is the state and church completely fused.
Yes, in one person's body, Queen Elizabeth II. But the reason it works is because no one takes it seriously, right? It's just nominal. It's just on paper. And in a way, that is the end game, to my mind, of Israel. That it's a Jewish state in name only. That no one that you really do have the real and manifest possibility of non-Jews gaining political office, gaining esteem, gaining property, and so on and so forth. That there's a real kind of equality in the public square for Jews and non-Jews. And I think sometimes, you know, I don't know, Sam Harris is an interesting guy on this, because I think his view is broadly in line with that. But earlier on, he was very kind of intense atheist. And he thought you have to start by changing the words. You have to stop thinking of Israel as a Jewish state. And Israel has to stop thinking of itself as a Jewish state in very open and expressed terms. And then that'll change the reality on the ground. I think it's better to go the other way, you know, like the UK did. You can keep the nomenclature, but just have coalitions between Arab and non-Arab political parties, between Muslim and Jewish parties, and so on. Have people working together in business, have people learning together in schools, have people playing together in sport and inventing together, and so on. And the last few years of relative peace have been good for that. And there are very important parts of Israel's democracy that strongly and robustly defend the rights of non-Jewish and or Arab Israelis.
Like supporters of Israel will say in response to that, that that's already in many senses the case. Like, for example,
exactly.
I think there's some Arabs on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And the other senior spheres, there's Arabs in Parliament. You know, it's not just non-Jews. It's, you know, Arabs who are their main sort of antagonists in the area.
Historically. Very much. I'm saying that this was happening, that this has been happening for a long time, and that it's been getting better and better in the last few years. And what this that we've seen in the last few days does, and in the last few weeks in the build-up to the little mini war so far, is turn neighbor against neighbor. And good neighbors are, you know, good fellow citizens are really the greatest asset in a public square. So it's that erosion that you spoke to of these sort of open political alliances, and really at the grassroots levels, just, you know, neighbors getting along, being happy that their kids play together, being happy to meet each other, and so on. That's very sad. It's very sad. Beyond the death in terms of go forward. It's a problem. So I just want to contextualize this by saying I think that, yeah, we probably irritated everyone. There's one kind of interesting person who feels like, okay, here's what's irritating. This fight's been going on forever and it just, and, you know, everyone's either on one side or on the other side and it's too much. Like, why should we care so much? Don't we talk about this kind of thing much too much? You know, there's terrible things happening all around the world. How many times did you guys do a podcast on terrible incidents in the Rohingya genocide and the Ethiopia? Well, as it happens, you know, people who've listened to this podcast a long time will know that we hardly ever talk about this.
We do actually talk a lot about that stuff, actually.
We talk about that other stuff. We hardly ever talk about Israel-Palestine. It is an important thing to talk about when the time comes. And just notice this. Since the plague, it's almost been as if everyone's getting their turn. All the old stories have had their turn to be dramatically and arrestingly developed in the global public sphere. So the first one to really get its turn was, in a way, the sort of black race nationalist movement or black Pan-Africanist movement. After the killing of George Floyd, terrible thing. We did a podcast about that. You know, I think the conviction was correct. The allegation that this was racist in this particular case, unsubstantiated entirely. The allegation that there's broad systemic racism in terms of police killing black armed men, very much contradicted by the facts. If anything, it goes the other way. Police are less likely to shoot and kill unarmed black people than other people by incident. So police brutality should have been the issue. That didn't get its turn. What did get its turn was sort of black race nationalism. I think that China very much got its turn kind of before that as like an issue for people to rally around, either for or against, mostly against in the circles we're in. In South Africa, I think
the outrage about China has certainly animated my spirit probably more than anything else in the past 2 years.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's fair to say I'm probably more antagonistic towards China than you are. Although I know you also are not a friend of the Communist Chinese Party.
No, I'm not a friend of the party. I think that America got its turn in a really big way, as opposed to just sort of black race nationalism or something, with the end of the Trump.
That whole mess,
incitement to violence and the storming of the White House and all that. So there have been these and of course libertarians have strangely gotten their turn in terms of the kinds of anti-mask riots in the Netherlands and parts of Europe and in America and so on and so forth.
It's funny how little the
Taiwanese got their turn with the freedom pineapples, which I really liked.
Oh, yes. Those were very good. It's weird how little coverage those continental anti-mask riots get as opposed to the US, at least in the English-speaking press.
Yeah. I think a lot of journalists can't speak Italian, so they don't.
That's true. Yeah, but I mean, they get reported, so it's not like the facts are not available. But there just doesn't seem to be kind of interest in the media in them. It's kind of weird. It's I guess some of it is a sort of culture war belief that the only people who could be against masks are like rednecks who vote for Trump. And that, you know, when sort of, you know, supposedly super sophisticated people in the Netherlands who are often held up, especially by people on the left in America, as like, you know, the paragons of culture and virtue, you know, clash with riot police over mask wearing doesn't really fit the worldview very nicely. Yeah. Europeans are supposed to be above that.
I think more attention did go to Australia.
Yes.
And Australia is like the new America in a way. You know, it's even further west if you keep going in the same direction.
It's
got a lot of the same kind of new money, crass, like every Australian I see just more and more. When I was 22 or whatever, the only Australian accent I was used to hearing on the television was the sort of good-looking blonde doctor in House, the TV show. And now it's, oh, look, it's just Australians everywhere. And they, with the exception
especially of Kate, a lot of acting, actually.
Yeah, with the exception of Kate Blanchett, who is an ideal person.
You mean Lady Galadriel?
No, I mean Kate Blanchett, dude. What was his name? Ben Brantley was the great New York Times theater critic who, as one study once showed, a bad review from him would cost the production at least $4 million. He really had clout. I think, described Kate Blanchett as the greatest actress of her generation. I think a lot of people don't know she's a stage actress who sometimes appears in movies.
You seem to be drawing a distinction here as though Kate Blanchett and Lady Galadriel are different people. Which I don't think has been proven. That's why they cast her for the role, because she was just playing herself.
I hear you. Okay, but so most of the Australians are just like really brash and outre, like Jim Jeffries. Like they're just like more Americans than Americans. And so it kind of makes sense that they riot against wearing masks, and they got a little bit of their turn on that front. South Africans, not so much.
Australia is like the one country in the world where you can buy a farm and basically be your own country, because the farm is so big. You can just go out into the drive from your front gate to your house can be 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a different world.
And it'll be hot.
Yes.
It'll be piping hot. Yeah, so yeah, the Middle East has its turn to freak everyone out. And it's a good time. You know, I think it's an interesting, there's something esteemy about it that's very interesting. Like, I change my mind about that conflict all of the time, in the sense that new facts get updated.
Hmm.
New facts about this particular case of the properties that, you know, have these contesting claims for ownership and residency. New facts updated about the status of Israel's defense and attack system, and about the neighbor's defense and attack system. New facts about the elections being canceled. You know, the story evolves in that sense. But I'm not sure that my sort of esteem vibe has changed, in the sense that, like, as a teenager, I was, I suppose, quite aggressively pro-Palestine, as were most of my fellows, saying, "Hey, Joe, you know,
that was back when you were a misguided lefty, Gabriel."
I was changed, but it didn't take long. I mean, I was still young in the first part of my teens when that change occurred on this issue as well. So now, anyway, the reason I say this is because most of the, aside from the professional media, and I really avoid the sort of mentioning, you know, I try and stick to Reuters and AP News on these things. And
Reuters has put up a paywall now, which is very annoying, but anyway.
Yeah, but the app is still pretty good. AP News, I must say, I've gone from being a Reuters man to being an AP News man.
Okay, I'll check out AP News myself as well.
Yeah, but most of the Facebook stuff is just like pick a side, right?
Oh, yeah, no, Facebook is terrible.
And Trevor Noah is my favorite one. It was reposted by a lot of my friends. He's like, I'm not going to pick a side, but, you know, really, Israel's so big and strong. And Palestine's so little, like, you've got to be on the Palestinian side.
But one side is wrong, yeah.
Well, one side is big, and big is wrong. Sort of. I'm just not on either side in that sense. Like, I'm on the side of democracy, rule of law, stability. So in those senses, I'm definitely far, you know, Israel checks a lot more boxes for me than any of its neighbors, really. And so I want more of its neighbors to be more like Israel, and I want Israel to be more like the UK.
So
Yeah, so I'm stuck in that. Like, I think short of a miracle, like, or getting bonked on the head, I don't think that's going to change in me. And so I feel almost disingenuous talking about it because in that sense, I don't have an open mind. I mean, technically I do. I suppose someone could persuade me that an autocratic form of theocracy is, which is kind of race-based and I can't even finish the sentence. I just can't imagine someone persuading me that that's the better way to go about things. And that impulse is an undercurrent in Israeli politics that threatens to grow and is the dominant current in Hezbollah, Hamas, the Ayatollahs of Tehran.
Even in Fatah.
And so it's like on the basis of those standards, I just can't draw a comfortable moral equivalency between the major political actors. So, you know, I'm not pro-Israel, anti-Palestine, but like on my basic standards of political science and my norms of what ought to be implemented so that people can enjoy liberty and prosperity. There's just one side is much closer than the other. And so I want the other side to come closer to that side and that side to grow. Okay, I'm repeating myself, but do you see where I'm coming from, Nick? Like,
yeah, I know.
Like it's hard to weigh into this thing while holding on to one's principles and holding on to a kind of generosity of spirit towards the political factions.
You've quite nicely explained the difficulties that you have with this issue. So I would describe myself as pro-Israel, although I don't get animated about it, because it's not like I don't think that there aren't some legitimate grievances on the other side. I just think that, that one side has sort of the better argument of it for the most part. And I think part of the reason for that, and this is, I think, what you'll find sort of controversial, is that I am a bit more sympathetic, I think, to the idea of a Jewish state than you are. Now, I agree with a lot of your criticism there that it's a bit problematic, to use a lefty term,
don't let the left own that term, monopolize that term. There are problems. There are problems that we can all see. We don't have to.
I'm not a huge fan of ethno-religious states. I like identities that anyone can enter or exit very easily. I think those are the best things to form states around. Things that are not sort of all-encompassing, identities that are not all-encompassing, tend to be the best things to form a state around. And so, ethno-religious state, not terribly comfortable with it. But I do think the Jews have a stronger argument than most from history, that they have this sort of unique history where it's not entirely unique, but they have been a minority in a lot of places.
And an abused minority, a terribly, viciously, and genocidally abused minority. Absolutely.
Right. And so the idea that they could have a single place from which to sort of establish themselves and protect those customs, those traditions, those religions, and those people from abuse or destruction or marginalization is fairly solid. Now, I think I do agree that I would never accept an Israeli state that discriminated against its Arab citizens in like a very serious way. Like, as is the claim often made about it, that it's an apartheid state is what pro-Palestinian people say. So, if Israel really was like that, I wouldn't be happy with it. But the idea that it is, sort of first a Jewish state in character is I think not a completely crazy one.
No,
it's fairly managed and controlled and doesn't go overboard.
So I agree with you, and I've made this argument right that to be a non-racialist is only really sensible if you understand and are prepared to define and admit the limits to non-racialism. So I am a non-racialist. It's firstly how I was brought up. It's secondly something that comes very naturally to me. It's thirdly my professional life. I am about as serious as this about this as anyone that you can find, although I am admittedly not always a serious person and make silly jokes. But I see, as part of the duty of that seriousness, an obligation to define the limits. And I see that limit very clearly in the history of apartheid. I see very clearly the argument for black race nationalism in the 70s. The black consciousness movement guys saying, from the 50s, saying, look, we don't want white people in the ANC or in leadership positions or whatever, because actually things are too hectic. Things are too discriminatory. We are too oppressed to do that. The best way for us to rally support, to shift the esteem market, to then shift the power
to unite around our race,
is to unite
around. Hold on, someone is drilling a wall, so I just need to shut them up.
Okay, I'm going to keep talking while they're. Now, my view is that there was and remains always a better way. I myself don't see a moment in South Africa's history since 1910 where I could find any justification for myself to be a part of an all-white group. And if I were born earlier, you might as well think of me as being born with a different color skin, because I'd have a different mother in any event if I was born earlier. So if I'd been born black in 1910, I hope that I would be like many of the black people who were part of the Institute of Race Relations in the 20th century, who really wanted to work together with white people and right. colored people and Indian people on a non-racial basis. So I think there's always a better way, but I think it's imprudent to criticize or alienate oneself from people who are taking the race nationalist stance under conditions that are something like a war, but more technically under conditions that deviate so far from the rule of law under a constitutional democracy that you've basically gotten to something like a Hobbesian state of nature where it's really just a clash of forces. So in the same vein, I completely agree that a minority that's been discriminated against on both the basis of race, Semiticism or whatever, and the basis of religion, Judaism,
right,
has a very compelling argument to form something like an ethno-religious state. And I fully support the constitution of Israel. I fully support its Six-Day War, for example. It was not the initial aggressor, you know.
Well, it wasn't a Six-Day War, but it was like genuinely a preemptive strike because you know, its opponents were massing their armies right on the border and were
yes.
and literally they days from invading
Egyptian right.
Air Force in one day. Yeah.
So okay, so I'm just saying I agree with that principle. Actually, I agree with the argument that it needs to be established that way. I'm just saying the long game. Look, Israel's going to be around for 300 years.
Yeah.
I can't really see much further into the future than that, but I think it's a safe bet that it's going to be around.
Yeah,
I can't
that's a good
see
bet.
300 years. Okay, you know what I'm saying? And in 300 years, it'd be nice for there to be like an Arab, you know, it'd be nice for Israel's politics to really be open enough that, for example, an Arab person could be elected prime minister.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth.
I think that kind of thing is possibly, you know, is even possible at the moment that there was sort of some genuine peace in the region between yeah. the two sides. When the Palestinian issue is settled, I think that might become quite likely.
Exactly.
The only problem is that conflict drags on.
Yeah. And so I think where we agree is that like where things are wild enough, natural enough, state of nature enough, that it really is force rather than rules that are dictating the background conditions for people's lives. The argument for the Israeli state in this sort of ethno-religious constitution is stronger. But that's not an ideal state either for Israel or for anyone.
Right.
And it's that journey which has to be piecemeal, incremental, exactly the kind of thing which, you know, like not radical, like almost conservative. Conservative in the sense that there is room for growth, but
in the Burkean sense.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Burkean conservative.
Conserving, what did he say? Reforming to conserve.
Exactly. So that reforming to conserve, that is undermined right now. And what is strengthened is the most radical thing, which is death and violence. So.
Yes. Oh, well, you see, here I was thinking we were going to have an argument. We ended up agreeing. Isn't that wonderful? You also had a plan for this episode, and I see we've actually just reached an hour.
Yes. I abandoned my plan. But I'll just warn the listeners about what's coming next week. So, if I manage to pull off my plan next week. So, 2 weeks ago, I told the listeners about Shelby Steele again. We'd already talked about his movie.
You read out an anecdote from his, or you didn't read out an anecdote, but you described an anecdote.
I described an anecdote. Yeah. And what I really want to do is just read a page from this book that he published in 1989. Read out a couple of paragraphs here, a couple of paragraphs there. Because I think that Shelby Steele's prose, his own words, have a weight that the retelling doesn't quite get to. I'll reiterate my recommendation. If you can get your hands on The Content of Our Character, it's called, by Shelby Steele. It's a collection of essays from 1988 and 1989, published in 1989, and available in some sort of very classy bookstores. And by classy, I mean like really like secondhand.
Only the best bookstores.
Gems. The kind of like hovel where you walk in and it smells like dust and no one's been there excepting like a student who went looking for some copy of Plato, whatever. Anyway, I found a copy there, but I'm still using my colleague's copy that she lent me. Anyway, check out that book. You can also get it online. And I say that because every essay is its own self-contained atom bomb for the mind. And particularly for, you know, I think it's amazing because he does such a good job of merging the personal, the political, the grand narrative and the kind of view from nowhere, the kind of neutral, objective, scientific almost approach to sociological analysis. He really balances all three of those in quite a seamless fashion. It's great, and I'll try and read out a little bit of that, and Nick and I will talk about it if we can. But in the meantime, that's my recommendation because we'll only be able to touch on the tip of the iceberg.
Cool. Right. Well, I'll keep it short because I have to let the drilling commence. The drilling that interrupted us earlier. I guess I'd recommend the thing that I wanted to do last time but forgot, which is a YouTube video. If you go look for it, it's if you search for largest political party since 1950, it'll come up with this. So one of the omissions in it does not include political parties which no longer kind of exist in the same form. So for example, the Soviet Union's Communist Party is not included there. But the Chinese Communist Party, the Indian National Congress, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party are all included in that list. And it's really interesting to see how the world changed between 1950 and now. And one of the interesting things there is that in 1950, apart from maybe the Soviets, the largest political party in the world was that's still around today is the Democrats. And nowadays, it's the Bharatiya Janata Party, the Indian People's Party, which is the ruling party of India, which has something like 112 million members, which is phenomenal.
That was the sound of me trying to imagine 112 million people belonging to the same party.
Yeah, it's just like, you know. We've talked about India a little bit before, which is the scale of that place in terms of human capital is incredible.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a short little YouTube video. It's just showing these bar graphs going up and down. And that whole channel is actually interesting. They've got like GDP since 1870, military spending, army size, stuff like that. It's all sorts of cool, interesting stuff to look at. Gives you a weird perspective on history, I think. But anyway,
good.
All the time we have for this week. So I hope you all have a great week, and we will see you next week. Keep the flag of liberty flying.